Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Beth.
And I'm Ava. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience and psychology while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
And this week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Andrew Kim, who is an assistant professor at the University of Calgary, and he researches addiction and mental health. So he looks at the relationship between addictions and mental health. We speak about the different kinds of addictions people can have. We speak about future treatments that look promising for people suffering from addiction. And we also speak about, which was really cool, how our governments and other people should be involved in addressing these kind of treatments. So I hope you guys enjoy.
My name is Dr. Andrew Kim. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Calgary in Calgary, Canada. I'm also a registered clinical psychologist and a psychologist at the Royal Ottawa Mental Health Centre. I'm also the chair of the Addiction Psychology section for the Canadian Psychological Association.
So your research looks at addictions and mental health. Could you explain the different addictions in your research and how these relate to mental health?
Yeah, of course. I just want to first start out by talking about how I got into researching the different types of addictions. So I started out being interested in gambling, and I did an addictions counselor certificate after my undergraduate studies. And before that, I wasn't too interested in gambling, but I took a course and I was fascinated by the idea that a behavior could develop into an addiction similar to substances like alcohol and cannabis, but you're not ingesting a substance. And so I got interested in to see how, okay, so how does a behavior like gambling, which I knew could be compulsive, in what ways can that be similar to the physical dependence and addiction symptoms that alcohol or cannabis can provide? So as I got more interested in it, I did my research, I took courses, and realized that there were a lot of similarities between a behavioral addictions, which they're called now, like gambling, and a substance addiction like alcohol. Then I began working with individuals with gambling problems and alcohol problems as well, and I noticed many similarities, especially in regards to what clients perceive to have caused their addiction, whether it was gambling or alcohol, treatment strategies that are used to help both, as well as the risk factors that people say this is what led to developing a gambling problem or an alcohol problem. And these similarities are actually reflected in the DSM-5 and the ICD-11, where gambling and gaming, to a certain extent, are now recognized as an addiction, similar to, say, alcohol and cannabis. And so in regards to what I study now, I study various addictions, but I mostly study gambling, gaming, alcohol, and cannabis, although I do some research on compulsive sexual behaviors.
I don't think many people will think that gaming could be an addiction. Could you just explain a little bit about that?
So gaming is the other, I would say, big behavioral addictions. Now, the area of behavioral addiction is controversial. There are, I would say, two mainly recognized behaviors that can be classified as an addiction based on research, right? So it's not just based on clinical anecdotes, but a lot of research that goes on to say in what ways are these similar to substance addictions that we see in terms of their development or risk factors, what maintains them, and the treatment strategies. So in the DSM-5, gambling disorder is included as an addiction alongside alcohol, cannabis, etc. Gaming disorder is in section 3, which is essentially an area that says, you know, there is some evidence, there is some support, but we need more to truly classify this as an addiction. In the ICD-11, which is the World Health Organization's classification of diseases, gaming disorder is included as an addiction alongside gambling. And that's because it kind of leads to similar clinical profiles. If you think of the risk factors, if you think of treatment strategies, what maintains them. And so can lead to people gaming more than they intended, experiencing negative harms and consequences, etc. And in regards to your question about how they're related, addictions and mental health, there are essentially four possible ways, or I could say three, The first is that addictions can lead to mental health symptoms. And the best example of this is there is now evidence to suggest that cannabis may be a trigger for psychotic-like experiences or psychosis, where the addiction can lead to the development of mental health symptoms. Mental symptoms can lead to addiction. This is commonly known as the self-medication hypothesis, where people are using or engaging in addictive behaviors to help cope with negative emotions and distress. Third, there's like a common factors model. So there's something common to both that leads to both an addiction to mental health. A good example of this is early childhood trauma, which we know is a risk factor for both mental health and addiction, whereas the two may not be related, but there's something else going on. That's a risk factor for both, or they could be unrelated. So I say four, but there's really just three pathways.
Cool, because my next question was going to be, do we know if addictions are the cause or consequence of mental health disorders? But I guess you just answered. And not surprisingly, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, and that's the million-dollar question, right? It's the chicken and the egg, really. Is it the addiction? Is it the mental health? Is it both? And this might be a very psychologist answer, but it is likely both, and it depends on the individual. In my clinical work, when I ask patients about their addictions and what do they believe is causing or maintaining the addiction, they often tell me they use or engage in addictions to deal with their trauma, their pain, their anxiety and depression. Essentially, what they tell me is that they're self-medicating with substances. Now, of course, not everyone develops an addiction because they're managing with mental health, but at least when I see them in clinical settings, I work mostly in concurrent disorder specialized settings. I often hear that it's a way to cope. I've also recently published a study that asked people that have lived experience with addiction from a lay epidemiological perspective, essentially just asking people who said they have experienced a problem with an addiction, particularly in this case was gambling, gaming, and substance use, and simply ask them, what do you believe was the cause of your gambling addiction, your gaming addiction, your substance addiction? And the most common response, which ended up being about 35% of all responses, was that they were coping with distress, that this was a way to manage their pain. Now, there were some differences based on proportion of what they believe was the cause of their gambling, alcohol, gaming, etc. But the most common by far was it was a way to cope.
Yeah. When people listen to this, I feel like that would make sense. The people you know that are struggling with things or, yes.
No, for sure. Have mentioned that addictions is insidious and that it works. In the short term, it's a powerful way to alleviate or manage your negative emotions. In the long run, it leads to other problems, and it's a double-edged sword, right? It's an unhelpful coping mechanism because it creates more problems in the end. But in the short-term immediate relief, and I imagine even if people don't experience an addiction or have problems with alcohol, they may have experience after a long day of work or when they've just been really frustrated or really stressed, having a glass of wine, having a beer, having whiskey, and how much that relaxes them in that moment. So in the short term, it works. In the long term, it's just going to worsen everything.
That's also another really good point. So how do you diagnose someone with an addiction? So I feel like we hear a lot about how people are diagnosed with depression and anxiety. But is it the same thing with questionnaires how do you diagnose someone?
Yeah, so clinical diagnosis can't be done with questionnaires. It's done by clinical interviews and addictions. And I guess with depression, anxiety too, it's language that's commonly used, right? I see this in advertising and marketing. This game is 100% addictive, right? So they throw this terminology around. And I mean, we use it every day too. This chip is really addictive. I can't stop eating it. But when we talk about a clinical diagnosis of addiction, we really mean something very specific. And it depends on which criterion you're using. There's the DSM, as I mentioned, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders, or the WHO's ICD-11. And when it comes to the DSM, for substance use disorders, there's 11 criterion. And for gambling and gaming, there's 9. But you can distill these into four, I commonly categorize them into four broad categories. The first is impaired control. So that's when you often use more than intended. So let's take alcohol, for example. Say I'm going out to a bar with my buddies. I'm going to have 3 drinks. But you end up having 7, 8, 9. So you set limits, but you exceed them. And the key here is that it's often. Have I exceeded limits sometimes? Absolutely. I say, yeah, I'm just going to go off my buddies, have maybe 2 or 3. I end up having 4 or 5. Is it often? No. But people with addiction often exceeds limits. One of the biggest ones as well is if you ever felt wanting to control or cut down on your drinking, but you're unable to. So this again speaks to that impaired or loss of control. There's a social impairment component. It's when the addiction is causing negative consequences. So it's interfering with work, it's causing problems with your partner, and you're still using. One of the ones that I've seen in the past is I've had a patient who had liver cirrhosis caused by alcohol, kept drinking. So there was a clear negative consequences, but they kept using. There is use in risky situations. The biggest example is alcohol is driving under the influence. We all know this is dangerous, it's wrong. Yet there's that inability to not use while driving. And then there's the physical dependence component, which is tolerance. That's needing to drink a lot more to get the same desired effects than you're used to. And withdrawal is experiencing both physical symptoms like sweating, nausea, headaches, and psychological symptoms like anxiety, irritability when you're not drinking. And so there's 11 criteria across these 4 broad categories. And to meet criteria according to the DSM, 2 symptoms in a 12-month period. So 2 to 3 is considered mild substance use disorder. 4 to 5 is considered moderate substance use disorder. And 6+ is considered severe. The ICD-11 has 3 criterion, and it's impaired control. Again, that loss of control. Increasing priority, which we call preoccupation, where if you think about your life, right, you have various priorities. You have various hats that you wear. So you can be a student, you can be a partner, you can be an athlete, work, whatever it is. But the substance use, alcohol, is taking more of that pie. It's becoming defining. We're spending more time engaging that addictive behavior. And then continuing or escalation of use, again, despite negative consequences, causing interpersonal problems, causing work problems, causing physical problems, yet you still use or use more despite these harms.
So you kind of also have already touched on this, but you look at risk factors for substance and behavioral addictions. Mm-hmm. So I guess we've already spoken about how trauma is a risk factor. Mm-hmm. What are some other things that are risk factors for people developing this?
Yeah, so there are, I would say, more similarities in regards to risk factors. And there are theories and models that conceptualize addictions to represent an underlying disorder. So think of addictions as a whole as a one disorder that just expresses itself differently, whether it's alcohol, gambling, gaming, sex. And part of it is there's common risk factors that have been developed. Now, these aren't all unique to addictions. They're mostly seen in mental health as well. But trauma is a pretty common one. Adverse childhood experiences. Mental health is a robust risk factor. So individuals with a mental health disorder are 2 to 3 times more likely to develop an addiction compared to those that do not have a mental health disorder. Social determinants of health. So lack of housing, homelessness, food insecurity, these are all risk factors for addictions as well. Availability, which is interesting. So there's some evidence to suggest that more available a certain substance or behavior is, the higher rates. So the most common addictions in, say, Canada, but I imagine the same in Australia, are those that are society deems legal. Alcohol, cannabis, because it's legal in Canada, nicotine, they tend to be the high base rates. So availability is an interesting one. Not always, but it could be. There are some unique differences in terms of risk factors. I've done research in this as well. As I mentioned, when I asked people, what do you think was the cause of your addictions? Well, coping was the biggest one. One of the interesting ones was social determinants of health. So lack of finance, lack of housing was a pretty big driver for gambling, I would say, which makes sense. Like gambling, again, health has the edge. You're going to lose more than you win. But if you need $1,000 to pay rent, gambling might be a way, people think it might be a way to be able to get that amount of money in a legal capacity, in a sense, quickly.
Availability is also interesting because I'm not sure if it's the same in Canada, but in Australia, we advertise a lot for gambling, like for the casinos that we call it the pokies, those slot machines, all that stuff. And when I have friends visiting from overseas, they're really shocked by that because in a lot of other places, you can't advertise, you know, put money on this race or things like that. And yeah, there's a lot of discussions like we should stop doing that. It's not a good thing to be doing. Yeah.
So I know Australia and UK have been dealing with this. Canada, we're just starting to see this in one province, actually, in Ontario. So in Canada, mostly gambling is operated by provincial governments. So it's provincially regulated. Wow. They're the operators and the regulators. In Ontario, it changed to allow these big international gambling companies to provide gambling opportunities. And what that has led to sports betting is this influx of advertisements where you see current athletes, superstars, being linked to gambling companies. And so I'm actually looking at a study right now that's going to compare Ontario in terms of the gambling rate, sports betting rate, the harms, and the impact of advertisements compared to the other provinces, which are more provincially regulated. So there's only one gambling company, let's say, whereas in Ontario, I think there's 30 plus, which speaks again to the availability, accessibility, how commonly you see it on TV, and to see if that impacts participation.
Okay, amazing. Well, that will be very relevant to Australia too. So we'll be looking out for that paper. Now to turn to your 2022 paper, where you looked at addictive behaviors and mental health symptoms in a group of undergrads and adults in the community. Mm-hmm. So to look at patterns in the group, you used a latent profile analysis. Can you explain what a latent profile analysis is and how you set up this study and what was the motivation for this study as well?
Yeah, of course. A latent profile analysis is a statistical method that tries to group people into homogeneous groups based on certain characteristics, right? So in our study, we had about 2,200 participants, 1,600 students that recruit across Canada, and 600 adults in the community, mostly recruited through Canada. There are some in the US, but you see the 2,200 people, and you try to find in what ways are they similar? Can you find similar groups among these 2,200 individuals? And what we were interested in trying to find similar groups is looking at their answers to addictions and mental health. So we asked them about their engagement and problems with variety of addictions. So substances like alcohol, cannabis, cocaine, and behavioral addictions like gambling, gaming, sex, shopping, etc., and the common mental health symptoms like anxiety, depression, ADHD, and trauma. And so we're all unique, right? So we're going to answer to these questions differently. And what latent profile analysis does is then try to see, can you group these individual responses into certain patterns? And it's a very data-driven approach because it will identify groups based on your data set. And so that's one of the limitations. So it's hard to replicate because it's a data-driven approach. And so when I do this, I'm not sure what I'm going to get. Am I going to get one group that are all similar? Am I going to get two groups where you can see one group that answers similarly to addictions and mental health and another that doesn't? And am I going to get eight groups? I'm like, oh my God, there's like a bunch of different groups here. So you never know what you're going to get. And so that was actually one of the rationale to recruit two different samples. Undergrad students, people call them weird, not weird as in like they're weird, but Western, educated, industrial, they have different characteristics, right? And so what we find in an undergraduate student sample may not be what we find in people that aren't students. And so that was the rationale to recruit two different samples to see, can we find different profiles? The other one was that we wanted to recruit at least 50% of individuals that identified as a racialized minority. Racialized minorities are underrepresented in psychological research. It's the same for addictions. And as a racialized minority, I know we have different experiences. And to see whether these profiles are equivalent across different racial groups. The other things that we wanted to do is in terms of comorbidity research or research that looks at addictions and mental health, they tend to examine one addiction, alcohol, gambling, cannabis, with one mental health, depression, anxiety. But we know that poly addictions are the norm, that people who develop an addiction tend to use multiple substances or engage in multiple behaviors. And mental health are also comorbid, they tend to go hand in hand. And so we wanted to look at profiles looking at various addictions and mental health. The second, we have really good data into how frequently addictions and mental health co-occur. Not so much as to the risk factors. There are good research, but I would say it's lacking compared to knowing the relative frequency of how often addictions and mental health co-occur. And so we did an online cross-sectional study, as I mentioned, recruiting 1,600 students across Canada, 600 adults, to see what are the profiles that we get in terms of their responses to addictions and mental health, and can we find differences in whatever those groups are to see, can we start to identify risk factors?
And what did you find with this study?
Yeah, so we found that if you take this data, a three-group profile fit the data best. Now, again, as I mentioned, this is a very data-driven approach, and there are certain indicators of what we call fit indices to see a three-group solution fits better than a two-group solution, fits better than a four. So we have some guidelines to say this pattern of responses or this grouping fits the data best. As I mentioned, the undergrads and community sample are highly different, which we found there were significant differences across all demographic variables. Yet, we found that a three-group solution fit the data best across both samples. The first group was what a lot of these studies consider the first group as normative. And it's hard to use the word normative because what's normal? But they're really the people that score low on addictions and mental health. So they're the people that say, I do not have current difficulties with addiction, substance or behavior, or mental symptoms. And across both, 60% of the sample relatively said, yeah, I don't really experience difficulties with these. The second group, they were characterized by having high scores on behavioral addictions, like gambling, gaming, and high scores on mental health. And this comprised about 30% of the sample. And 10% of the sample were characterized by high scores on substances, behavioral addictions, and mental symptoms. What I find striking about these results across, again, two very different groups, is that there were no profiles or groups that were characterized by just having difficulties with addictions or just having difficulties with mental health. Is that when scores on one of these are elevated, the other tends to be elevated as well, which we term like comorbidity or concurrent disorders. And when we looked at the risk factors, there were some differences between the behavioral addictions and mental health group and the substance use behavioral and mental health group. But the most differences were, you know, surprisingly between those who scored low on any measures or not experiencing any difficulties with addictions and mental health and those that had problems. And there's things like those who, with the concurrent disorder comorbidity profile, reported greater levels of impulsivity. They reported greater difficulties regulating their emotions. They reported greater childhood trauma and reported less social support.
It's interesting because I guess maybe before I thought part of the addiction was the mental health wasn't a separate diagnosis, if that makes sense. Like, of course, no one who has an addiction is kind of thriving, but maybe part of that, like it's all one thing, but I guess it is, you can diagnose them separately and it is more complicated than that.
Yeah. And addictions is mental health. Like, I mean, that's something that I know we talk about addictions, mental health differently, but addictions is mental health. It's just, I find addiction to be highly stigmatized. People still think it's a choice. It's free will. And there is maybe some voluntary component to it at the start. But when we talk about clinical diagnosis of addiction, it's a hallmark characteristic is impaired control, as you're losing control of it.
That's why I really liked when you were speaking before about that the addiction does serve the purpose, because in that moment it is doing something good for that person. That feeling gets relieved, that negative feeling that they have. And I think that that's really important to remember when we're talking about the stigma, that in that sense, that's the person is helping themselves in that short term.
1,000%. I've never had someone, when I ask them what brought you here today, when I work clinically, say, I wanted to become addicted, so here I am.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Addictions provide something in the short term. If it's all negative, people wouldn't be doing it. So I always ask, what's the function of it? What does it give you? Right? And the negative reinforcement cycle of addiction said, yeah, it can start by giving us positive emotions, right? To give us a benefit. But at the end, you're using to stop feeling like crap. It's a negative reinforcement cycle. And it's a cycle that continues. But it gives you something. There's a function of it. Yeah. And when I work clinically, I always try to find, what's the addiction doing for that person? What's maintaining?
Yeah, I think that's really, really important to think about. So now we're going to talk about some of your work that has suggested that integrated treatment is promising for individuals with substance and mental health disorders. Can you explain what this treatment is and what hope does it hold? I guess, why is it so promising?
Yeah, of course. And before I start that, I just want to say how I think sometimes our treatment for addictions and mental health are siloed or separated, right? As I mentioned, addictions is mental health, yet they're treated relatively in different systems. You have mental health services in one end and you have addiction services in the other end. And which unfortunately I find leaves some people in the gap, especially when I mentioned that addictions and mental health can co-occur and do co-occur frequently. Yet if they're treated in separate systems, it can lead to problems. And so there's three different ways that addictions and mental health, when they co-occur, can be treated. One is sequential, is when you get treated for depression first and then treated for cannabis or vice versa. And I've often heard from clients who have, say, an addiction to mental health. I went to go seek help for my anxiety. I disclosed that I use. They said, oh, we don't do that here. You have to get treated for your addiction first. Then they go to an addiction treatment center and they say, you know, I have problems with my cannabis use. I also suffer depression. Oh, we don't do depression here. You have to get depression treatment first. Where do they go? Right? So sequential is when you have to treat one before the other. But if they're related, how's that really working? And I have some research into what I call addiction substitution, or what's termed addiction substitution. When someone who recovers from one addiction, say gambling, then develops a problem with alcohol or cannabis. And I have to find this to be the case when there's an underlying mental health disorder and you've only targeted the symptom of addiction. So if you have a gambling problem, why don't we self-ban you from the casinos? Why don't we have all these strategies to help you stop gambling, yet we're not addressing that mental health symptom that is leading to the gambling in the first place? And so that's sort of the sequential approach. Parallel is better. It's when someone is getting help for both the addictions and mental health at the same time, but it's being done separately. So for example, I'm the clinician for addiction, you're the clinician for the depression, and we're working with this individual, but we may not be talking to each other on what we're doing, and we may not be really talking about depression on my end or addiction on your end. Integrated treatment is when the addictions and mental health are being targeted at the same time by the same team of clinicians or the same provider. So you're all on the same page regarding how the addictions and mental health are related. And I find, at least in Canada, it's done at specialized treatment centers. They're called concurrent disorders program, where it's an interdisciplinary team, physicians, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, op health, where as a team, we're targeting both at the same time. And what we know is that integrated approaches has currently the best evidence to help with concurrent disorders or comorbidities.
So if someone's experiencing issues like, you know, they don't have a job or they're homeless or things like that, does that come into this as well? Is it also working with people who can help people build back their lives, if that makes sense?
In an interdisciplininary team, absolutely. And if I'm 100% honest with you, when I work with clients and they don't have housing, they have lack of food security, I'm not talking about their distorted thoughts. Let's challenge those automatic thoughts that you have. No, it's getting them basic needs. Yeah. For some, especially with people who are experiencing lack of housing, sometimes the addictions is a survival mechanism. I've always felt uneasy about some treatments that take individuals who are experiencing lack of homelessness, put them into residential treatment for substance use, and say, look at all these positive outcomes. I'm like, well, yeah, you're taking them away from an environment where the substance use has some benefit and into a protected environment where, A, they don't have access, B, you're giving them shelter, and then you're surprised that when you throw them back out on the streets, they're using again. Like, that to me makes no sense, yeah. Right? So I think when it comes to social determinants of health, I always think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I know there's some controversies, but that basic foundational pillar of needing security, food, housing, if that's not met, how much psychological work can we really do?
Yeah, I've spoken to quite a few psychiatrists who really feel that very strongly. And, you know, depending on what country you're in, the government needing to support people on another level, which is where I think a lot of people will.
These really cool studies that about universal basic income, where they provide people who are experiencing homelessness or housing instability, giving them a certain amount of money. And there's always fears, oh, they're just going to go and use drugs. Majority use it on housing. Yeah. And their substance use decrease because you're giving them some stability and you're taking away the need for the substance, especially if it's used to cope with the current situation.
Yeah, exactly. It's always important to consider those factors as well completely. So I guess you've mentioned how these treatment approaches are currently being used. So what are the barriers to starting this kind of approach? And then what would the ideal future look like? Like what should governments, what should people start doing to use this approach?
This is a really good question as well, because there was a study done in the States that talked about what treatment are people with concurrent disorders or people experiencing addiction, what treatment systems are they getting? And less than 10% of people receive treatment that targets both or targets integrated treatment. So there's a gap. We know integrated treatments are the best or currently has the best evidence, yet 6% of people who need it are actually receiving it. And so we looked at, okay, what are the barriers? Why aren't we being able to offer more integrated treatments? And one of the things that came up was lack of treating opportunities for addictions, at least in Canada. There is a relative dearth of training programs for clinical psychology that provides training in addictions. There currently isn't any continuing education credits that provide opportunities for training in addictions, graduate training opportunities. So there's this barrier here. Part of it is stigma, but part of it is lack of training opportunities. So I think that is one barrier that we have and a solution that we need to increase training for psychologists to be able to work with people that experience an addiction problem. Barriers as well, again, they're separated, they're siloed. Addictions on one hand, I think it's getting better, but I think we can do a better job where there's this no wrong door approach that you don't get turned away because you have an addiction or mental because you sought the wrong treatment service, but there should be one access point where you can get treated for both. And so I'm hoping that the systems get more integrated, that you can go anywhere and get treatment for both. There are more specialized services, and there's just more clinicians' competence related to being able to work with both addictions and mental health.
Yeah, the training aspect is important to talk about, I guess. Yeah, we talk about the research a lot and then not think about, all right, and what it looks like. But yeah, obviously that involves training. We've spoken to someone who researches women's health, and she was saying that, you know, the med school training has to change in terms of understanding of women's health. So yeah, that's a really good point.
Like, it's starting from the ground up, right? Like, each year there are hundreds of trainees in clinical psychology and social work. Is giving them the foundational training from the start. And I always say, when I talk to students, I'm like, you already have excellent training in CBT. You have the foundational skills. CBT is one of the gold standard treatments for addictions. Let me show you how your foundation knowledge can be applied to addictions. And here are some unique considerations. But you have that base.
So it was funny when I was thinking about what I should talk about on this episode. I was thinking, oh, should I share about my life? Because recently I was talking to a friend and I was like, I feel like I get a lot more rejections than other people. And they were like, no, Beth, you get the same amount of rejections as everyone. You just tell everyone about your rejections. feel like we all get rejections. We just repress them and don't make them part of our identity. Whereas you're like, guess you didn't text me back. Guess what journal I didn't get into. And I was like, is this a good thing? Should I talk less about it? So I appear more. And they're like, no, keep talking about your rejections. I don't know.
I think it's also because you're so open and optimistic. You go for things more. So the proportion of rejections that you get is probably the same. But also, you know, from your research, your proportions of successes is probably the same, but the net amount is higher, right, than most people who aren't going after all those things.
So true. And then that all happens. And then I tell everyone. But my friend told me it's a good thing.
Open book.
Yeah. So this episode actually was really close to home for me because our family has lived experience with addiction. People in my family suffer from alcoholism, which is pretty common in Australia. I'm not sure how it is in other places, but in Australia, there's definitely a problem that we have here. So I really loved hearing about how Andrew, well, first of all, understands how serious and the implications of people suffering from addictions are, but also really cementing like it is not their fault. And there was something about that and having grown up around that and the consequences of when someone has an addiction is really severe. And I think if you're around any of that, you would definitely know that no one's choosing this. No one wants this. No one's choosing this. And the idea that in the moment, it's a behavior that is doing what it's meant to. So if you're suffering and you have a drink or you take a substance, it alleviates that suffering. I just really liked that he was speaking about it in this way. From my experience of people very close to me who suffer from this, that's definitely what I've experienced. But then also the hope of how we can actually support people. So it's like, okay, there's this thing happening. People are suffering and they go to this thing to alleviate that suffering. But then looking holistically, how do we change that behavior? Yeah, I don't know. It really resonated with me. And I was like, I am so glad that there's people like Andrew who care about this and want to help people in these situations, because I know lots of things have stigma, but I feel like addictions have lots and lots and lots of stigma. So I think it's really important that we have people researching and wanting to help people who really can have the full amount of empathy that should be there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, neither of us are clinical psychologists and both of us do more basic research. And a lot of the people that we have as guests often tend to be doing that as well. And a lot of it is great work that has implications, but they're not actually working specifically on implementing those things. And I don't communicate that much in my work with clinical psychologists. So I don't know how common this is. But one of the things that I really saw in Andrew's work that I was kind of surprised about was that it felt like it was really addressing these more structural issues. So in the research on the latent profiles analysis, it was really showing like, okay, we think, and that was surprising to me too, that there seemed to only be these three groups, one type of person who seems to be doing okay all around, and then one other group that is doing bad, but maybe only has these behavioral addictions in addition to these mental health issues, and then another who has all of these issues lumped together. I was kind of surprised to see that because I would have thought it would be more like medium problems, like some more of this, some more mental health symptoms, and then a little bit of addiction like on the side. And I think being able to see that type of research that is looking at these really big groups of people is kind of what you have to do if you want to translate that into actual treatment. And then, I mean, I guess he's a clinician. I guess that's what clinical psychologists do, is that they actually are working in the field, which is kind of crazy that it's so different from what other psychologists do, because we're just most of the time like behind our computers, maybe sometimes interacting, but more and more like we really don't interact with people. It was heartening to hear that, you know, when he's treating people, it's not just about, oh, I've learned that, you know, you need to retrain your thought patterns. It's, if you don't have housing, you probably need housing first. Like that's an issue that we need to figure out first. And to see someone really zooming out and being extremely responsible, it felt like, with both the research and how they're implementing the research, and like almost being humble in the sense that maybe his research isn't about the importance of having a home or not having food insecurity, but then realizing just doing CBT or whatever it is that you're focused on is not necessarily going to be the most important thing. Another thing that I was surprised about, because again, I'm so out of this world, like unlike Beth, I've lived an extremely privileged life in a lot of ways. So I don't have a lot of firsthand experience with addiction or even with severe mental health issues. But it's kind of crazy to like hear about the underbelly of the health system, of the fact that you come into a place where you're trying to seek mental health help. And as you said, Beth, you know, it feels that if you have addiction, it makes sense that you would also have maybe anxiety, depression. But then people are only trained in these silos to treat one of those things and literally turn you away if you have a comorbidity, which based on Andrew's work, everyone who has a severe issue in one probably has a severe issue in the other. It's crazy that that's not how it's treated. And that was really surprising to me because as a naive person, I would have thought, oh, if you're a trained mental health practitioner, maybe you specialize in addiction, but of course you would know how to treat something as common, I guess, as anxiety or depression. So that was really surprising to me. And I don't know if you've had experience with seeing clinicians or like seeing people deal with having that issue of things being siloed and not being able to get the help you need, even if that clinician is working on the specific issue you have. It's just that they say, oh, because you have this other thing, I can't help you with that.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool that Andrew spoke about that, because I think another thing, some of the stigma from these things come from is like, oh, well, these people just don't want help. I don't know who I'm being there. Just like
ghosts of practitioners past.
And that's just not true. And so many of these issues are because of the systems, and lots of people want lots of help. But imagine if you're someone who has anxiety and reaching out is a massive thing to do. Like, people can even feel that, like even having a little apprehension about doing the phone call. It's like, oh, who's going to call up today, booking a restaurant or something? And there's always like one friend in the group who's like, oh, I'll do it. So if you think about like that times 100, you seek help and you have anxiety about doing that. And then you do that and you don't have a positive experience because you're dismissed or told, oh, no, we don't do that. We just do that. Like what, like, of course that, how are you going to be able to go and do that again? And I've definitely seen the system play out in that way. And I mean, yeah, we're doing PhDs in psychology. So we know, okay, if someone needs help, you go this and you advocate for them and you can advocate for yourself and all these things. But not everyone knows that. So everyone will be like, if you go and you get help and they tell you that they can't help you, you just be like, okay, well, that's the way it is.
But I think even if you know that, and like, even if I know, okay, I have an issue, I'm going to try to find someone who can deal with it, then I get rejected, or maybe I meet with a practitioner who is not helpful at all, but I've spent 2 months trying to speak to that person. Like, how can you deal with doing that again when the reason that you're speaking to them is that you feel debilitated, you feel that, you know, you're not moving forward with other things in your life, like you're better off just then trying to deal with it, which probably involves more self-soothing, and then you kind of go back into the cycle. So I feel like every time we talk to people who are in mental health, it's like, oh, there's like people really trying to move and change things, and that's amazing, but it also feels very disheartening to realize that's how things are, especially as someone who's like not really in contact with those types of institutions and systems. And I naively would have hoped that they would have been better, at least in like not turning away people who have comorbidities. Like, that was really such a shocking revelation to me.
That's funny, because I was like, yeah, that all makes sense. But it was cool how Andrew was talking about how we can train clinicians and be like, okay, so we have this issue with the system, whatever, but we do have these clinicians who have gone through med school, whatever they've gone through. So can we do extra training so they can manage these cases, which are extremely common? So it's like, okay, but we do the research, we see the problem, we know there needs to be government changes and everything, but also what does it look like to train up clinicians, and how can we approach that as well? Wow, he was doing everything, wasn't he?
I know. Every step. That's what, yeah, I was listening to it. I was like, cool, cool. And I was like, oh, he's doing it. Next step, he's like, got it. Yes, I'm training them myself. Yeah, but I think that's true, that this seems like such a failure of the system, that like the most common thing, since everyone seems to have these comorbidities, that people aren't trained to do that. But it wouldn't necessarily be an overhaul of the system to train people.
Before we finish, would you like to just share what you're working on next that you're excited about?
Yeah, of course. There's several things that I'm really excited about. One is it dovetails into the lack of training. So as with the Canadian Psychological Association, I'm currently working on an initiative to provide continuing education credits with a team that will, I hope, at least fill a gap at the start to be able to have clinicians who are interested in working with people with addictions to be able to provide that service. I'm also really excited about a study that we're doing now looking at pathways. As I mentioned, people tend to be turned away. We don't know how people who have addictions mentality seek treatment. My guess is that their first entry point to treatment is not at a specialized treatment center. It could be in the emergency department. It could be social welfare. So to look at what are the trajectories, what are the treatment pathways, can we optimize them? Can we identify people who need help? And can we direct them into appropriate services sooner? And are there specialized needs for racialized minorities, underrepresented groups, sexual gender minorities, indigenous peoples? And can we find optimal treatment pathways for them? And a lot of the studies on concurrent disorders, like risk factor-wise, tend to be cross-sectional. And so I'm setting up a series of studies that will look at this longitudinally.
Thank you to Dr. Andrew Kim for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Montesouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.